Welcome back to the podcast, mates. This one was a real treat for me, and forgive me for a longer introduction to this episode, but since Yoss and I got right into it, I want to provide some context for just how unbelievably complex this company is, and also hopefully let it shine through just how significant this company is to the sort of global order and supply chain, at least when it comes to electronic devices. And I also just want to say about the intro that I really try to make them as informative and contextual as possible rather than just some sort of self-serving embellishment. You know, I want to introduce the subject, the person, and then provide enough context for the chat so as soon as the recording starts, we're all on the same page. All right, so here we go. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in Amsterdam just to catch up with some old mates of mine, but I also knew about this amazing ASML company that was in the Netherlands, down in Vlaardingen, which is next to Eindhoven in the south of the country. And I wanted to make sure I made the most of my time in the Netherlands. And so I reached out to ASML with a proposal to write an article about them, sort of profiling their business. The Netherlands is packed to the brim with amazing companies. Similar to Sweden, they boast a remarkable economy with quite a few multinational legacy businesses as foundation, and they don't necessarily rely on the natural resources or any sort of given wealth for their prosperity. They truly are a knowledge economy. And of all the companies you could name as being famously Dutch, Booking.com, Philips, Dewey Egberts, which if you haven't heard of is a coffee company, a Nestle rival and just grubby as hell, but I think the second largest purchasers of coffee in the world. So just an incredible agricultural business. But that's some of the big Dutch company names that you might be aware of. But in addition to these big names, the Netherlands houses one of the most important businesses in the world, absolutely fundamental to the supply chain of electronic goods, which obviously, as we know, is kind of the bedrock of our functioning society. And this company is ASML. And ASML stands for Advanced Semiconductor Material Lithography. And so they're a company that admittedly very few people would have heard of, myself included, until I heard it being mentioned by a guest on an Equity Mates podcast. And that's kind of remarkable because without the existence of this company, the world would actually look very different. And that is because without this company, the market for semiconductors, which is just interchangeable jargon for microchips, would be significantly less developed. And so therefore, in an alternative universe where ASML don't exist, semiconductors are more likely going to be more expensive and less efficient. So they would enable less computing power and cost a little bit more, which ultimately, as the dominoes start to fall and the ball gets rolling, has a lot of second, third, fourth, and fifth order consequences down the road. Because it is true that much of the technological innovation that becomes affordable to us comes off the back of the semiconductors getting more and more computing power out of less and less dollar inputs, ultimately following the foreshadowing something we're going to speak a lot about, which is Moore's Law. So ASML create the lithography machines that then go on to create the semiconductors or microchips the world is so hungry for. Okay, so let's introduce ASML and the chat. But first, and I really don't want to take advantage of your guys' amazing goodwill to listen to me, but first I do want to just say why this actually came about. It's because I'm writing a series of business profiles titled Bloody Good Business. And the first was published a couple of months ago about the Swedish oat milk company called Oatly. The second that is going to be published is this business profile of ASML. There is a fantastic Israeli startup company that I'm speaking about, a company called Planet, which just went public in the US, which could be one of the most remarkable companies in the world. And the more companies I profile and the higher the readership these pieces get, the more access it actually will then give me. So here, luckily with ASML, because of my Oatly profile, I got to go in, interview Yoss, I got a full tour, a full day's tour of the facilities, shook hands with a lot of people. It was a fantastic experience. I learned so much and it was really fun. It's like incredibly rewarding thing to do. And so if any of you are affiliated with business magazines that would be interested in publishing this or interested in talking, or if you're part of a business that wants to be profiled, that would be really exciting to do. So please do reach out. You will find access to my email on my website, which will be in the description. Okay, I'm sorry about that. I am very conscious of how long-winded this introduction might be, but I'm also trying to make my best conscious effort to make sure that it is all relevant and all necessary context to get the most out of what ultimately becomes the recorded conversation with Yoss. But ASML, what are they? So they are the company that creates, engineers, and then installs the machines that Samsung, TSMC, and other major semi semiconductor chip makers around the world use to manufacture their semiconductors. They create the engine that is then ubiquitously distributed to all the different chassis around the world. Each chip maker has their own unique recipe for the chip, but they all use ASML flour as the base. I could go on with cagey metaphors like this, but I think you guys get the picture. ASML do not create the chips themselves, but rather they create the machine that can then be repurposed to make the unique chip that, say, TCMS or Samsung, etc., would apply their own design to. Now, look at your fingernail for 3 seconds. No, seriously, do it. Look at your fingernail. 1, 2, 3. Your fingernail just grew a nanometer in length, an impossibly small distance. And what makes ASML machines so unbelievably complex is that they are printing via light onto silicon wafers down to nanometer accuracy and ensuring consistency and reliability via mass production of this process. Here I want to attempt to describe the complexity of this machine, since Jos makes the claim in this chat that ASML's latest product, which actually stands alone out there in the market as a unique monopoly on the highest end of chip manufacturing, called the Extreme Ultraviolet machine, is the most... Jos makes the claim that it is the most complex machine ever created by humans. And so let's get an idea for the complexity here. These silicon wafers, which are being printed upon, might appear flat to the naked eye, but at nanometer scale, they are in fact mountainous. It's like the old comparison I once saw in a VSauce video, that if the globe was shrunk to the size of the white ball in pool, it would in fact be considerably smoother than the white ball that we use on the pool table. And this is despite the heights of Everest and the depths of the Mariana Trench. At scale, our conceptions of things change, and it's almost impossible for us to appreciate it. It takes sort of a technician's mind, I think, or an engineer's mind to really appreciate it, or a mathematician's mind. So this nanometer precision depends upon total accuracy. And so to ensure that the light being printed onto this silicon wafer is precise, ASML engineered this balancing mechanism, which constantly flattens out and calibrates the silicon wafer to being level, so the nanometer light that is being printed onto is accurate. And this isn't even to mention the type of temperature control that is required in the machine. Whilst all of this is happening, the temperature in the machine needs to be kept within 1,000th of a degree Celsius, which is, again, not leaving a lot of room or margin for error. This is whilst heavy machinery is moving around, they somehow need to control the temperature to such a narrow margin. I hope I am conveying just how unbelievable this machine is. One of the amazing achievements of the ASML machine as well is the way that they manage their supply chain. So one of the components that is used within the machine is this piece of glass that is in fact the flattest material or the flattest object or thing ever created by human beings. So I think that is one of the panels of glass that reflects the light to sort of narrow it down. But it is just to highlight how amazing this machine is. One of its components is actually in itself an incredible feat of engineering. And this man I interview, Jos Spendschup, who will be introduced shortly, claims that this is in fact the most complex machine ever created by humans. And really, who am I to argue that? After what I saw in doing the tour of the facility, it becomes more obvious and obvious just how impressive the scientific and engineering feats are that go into making this machine. What makes this machine so ridiculously complex is the nanoscale on which everything is happening. The margin of error can't even be computed by the human eye, and in fact can't even be computed by a computer's eye either. It requires extremely sophisticated software, which they themselves create as well. They are in fact also one of the most remarkable software engineering companies in the world as well, to notice the accuracy and to maintain the order within the machine, because at the nanoscale there is not much room for error, and they cannot simply create a functioning machine that prints out microchips. That in itself is an impossible feat, but what they need to create is a machine that also reliably produces chips at scale, which means the machine needs to run consistently and fast and reliably. The more chips that they can print out per hour brings down the ultimate cost of the chip going into the machine. And so that brings a little bit of context to the microchip and semiconductor industry, which I'm obviously not going to be able to flesh out here in an introduction because it's very complex and has taken on quite a geopolitical angle in the last year. But demand for microchips is not quite exponential, obviously, but their demand is certainly steadily increasing every day. The manufacturers of these microchips, TSMC, Samsung, etc., have standards that have been benchmarked by ASML. You can think about the semiconductor industry as super high-end chips that go into our phones and our computers and the top-of-the-line smart devices, and then your average chip, which might go into, say, your TV or your fridge, or apparently a lot of them will go even into modern-day cars. So if you simplify the industry down to that sort of duopoly, high-end and average, ASML have the absolute monopoly on the highest end of chips. So I really am barely scratching the surface here in explaining what goes into making these machines. Jos speaks about it briefly towards the beginning of the interview, so just try to listen out to his commentary on, say, the tin vaporizing process, which again is just unreal to imagine that humans can pull off. But my goal with interviewing Jos was to unpack what goes into Moore's Law and understand what exponential means. So Moore's Law, what is it? At the core of Moore's Law is understanding what exponential means. And forgive me, I know that this is that you guys are a really smart audience and you all likely know, but just for the sake of it, I think it's fun to retell this classic exponential story anyway, because it is at the core of understanding what Moore's Law means. And so the exponential story goes as follows. The origins are up for debate, and although the details are simply aesthetic, across all renditions, the lesson is unanimous. Be extremely cautious of the exponential function. The inventor of chess requests that his ruler pays for him his brilliant invention, the grains of wheat, starting with one grain in the first square of the chessboard, two in the second, fourth in the third, and doubling continually until the board is filled. The ruler laughs at this request for such a low price and quickly agrees to play it. It is only when the ruler's treasurer intervenes, however, that he realizes he has agreed to pay more than all the value his kingdom could ever offer. Because if you exponentially increase the grains of wheat 64 times along the squares of a chessboard, starting with one grain, by square 64, you have 18 to the 19th power grains of wheat, which is, needless to say, a shit ton of wheat. So this figure is so large that it's supposedly 2,000 times the global annual wheat production in 2020. So naturally, the inventor of chess was executed because that's one way to get out of a debt. So Moore's Law is the promise that computing power improves exponentially every 2 years. Memory, processing speed, sophistication, almost everything internal that you prefer on your latest iPhone is the consequence of an exponentially improving microchip in relation to steadily improving hardware. It's not a law of physics or maths or anything of the natural world, but rather Moore's Law is a forward projection of a historical trend. There is nothing stopping the gods of randomness or complexity to throw a wall up to this progress, stopping everything in its tracks. But so far, every time 48 months elapse, the transistors on a microchip double, which is just to say the complexity to replicate double is a 100% improvement. Every 48 months, they improve by 100%. And this is a trick of mathematical language that reminds me of Nassim Taleb's quote on percentage changes. The difference between 2% and 3% isn't 1%, it's 50%. Complex systems operate on a scale not readily available to interpret through the language of letters. And such is the nature of things that compound, they can get out of hand quite quickly. A microchip the size of your fingernail contains billions of transistors, so it's easy to understand just how small the features on a chip need to be. Chip features are measured in nanometers. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter and 1/1,000,000,000 of a millimeter. For comparison, a human red blood cell is 7,000 nanometers in diameter, and the average virus is 14 nanometers. The smallest structures on the most advanced chips are currently 10 nanometers. ASML's extreme ultraviolet technology enables the scale of the smallest feature to be reduced even further. The smaller the features and the patterns that our systems can create, the more transistors manufacturers can fit onto a chip, the more the chip can do. This is forcing the function of Moore's Law. The question becomes, and this is one I ask Jos, how small can it actually get? For how long can you exponentially improve something until you get down to the atom? And Jos can in fact answer that. Personally, and considering what I saw in conversations I had with ASML employees, I think a continuation of an exponential increase to computing power is unrealistic, and instead we'll be moving to a slower growth that more resembles a linear and marginal increase rather than 100x improvement every 2 years. But to get this far is an unbelievable, unpredictable feat of engineering. There is absolutely no reason why the impossible cannot be recreated again. And so now, who was I speaking to? I spoke with Jos Benshop. Jos received his master's cum laude and PhD in physics from Twente University. Almost certainly pronounced that wrong, but it's a Dutch Twente, I don't know. In 1984, he started his career at Philips Research, first in Eindhoven, the Netherlands, later in Sunnyvale, USA, where he worked for the introduction of the compact disc rewritable. He joined ASML in 1997 as the program manager of next generation lithography, initiating ASML's early research programs on ion beam lithography, e-beam lithography, and extreme ultraviolet lithography. Currently, Jos is ASML's Senior Vice President of Technology and oversees research and system engineering. He has published more than 30 papers and has over 20 patents to his name. He is a SPI fellow and until recently was part-time professor at Twente University. He is a member of the Netherlands Academy of Technology and Innovation and appointed by the King as advisor to the Dutch government on topics of science, technology, and innovation. He is by far one of the most accomplished engineers and scientists in the technical realm of lithography in the world. And to speak with him was a real pleasure. He is Dutch in all of the best ways. He had a very inviting but also no bullshit presence, completely comfortable with my questions, even though they were quite unusual and not typical for the ASML PR interviews. Self-deprecating and humble, despite literally being one of the most important technicians in one of the world's most important companies. In this chat, we covered an explanation of exponential growth, what Jos thinks about Moore's law, why going to work for Facebook or Instagram is a complete waste of talent, complexity, and more and more and more. Cheers, Jos. I really had a blast, mate. And to all of you listening, stick around to the end where I will explain my ambition for this podcast. And we are now through this marathon of an introduction. So cheers for sticking with me, mates. I do appreciate it. And here is Jos Benshop. Yes, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off by asking you to just highlight for the listener how important to the functioning of society and the way that we view modernity a microchip, semiconductor, whatever the jargon is, how integral to the operations that is.
Well, it's fair to say society would be very different without the progress we made in semiconductor industry. I mean, look at, we're surrounded by devices, knowingly and unknowingly, that help us to communicate, to live our daily life, in our cars. So it's hard to describe how things would be without a semiconductor, but talk to your grandma and grandpa and you'll probably get a good feel on what it would be.
Yeah, well, in the experience center, it started off with the video on the floor and it sort of posed the exact same question and then it all went to black.
Yeah.
So it's not like it would be the end, but it would be, as you say, like generations pre-1950s, where I guess there just isn't electronic ubiquitousness in our lives.
No, I would even say if you would, I mean, there was a society before the semiconductor industry and it functioned in a decent way.
Mm-hmm.
But if today you would switch off all semiconductor industry, it would come to a grinding halt.
Yeah, it would be pretty chaotic.
Yes.
So it's functional as a foundation to the mobile ubiquitousness and the way that that has shaped our society. Without the semiconductor, the phone wouldn't be the way it is, the computer wouldn't be the way it is, etc.
Yeah, and I would say in good, bad, and ugly, mm-hmm. it would look very different.
Exactly.
I mean, there was a time where we made calls with a device that had a wire, and you mm-hmm. would only speak to it.
Mm-hmm.
And now your mobile phone you use for almost everything except calling. So once in a while you call, but I mean, it's your gateway to the rest of the world.
Yeah. With that as the context, I was thinking when in the framing of the article, going from asking what is a sort of a very hypothetical question, it's rather philosophical, no one really knows, but what is a first principle or a foundational input into the way that we currently exist within our different societies and cultures, right? And I think an answer to that, maybe clutching at straws, but an answer to that could be something like the overabundance of connectivity, you know, from all of the downsides of social medias to the upside of social media, to the way that work can be totally distributed. This is all, I think, very prominent ingredients into current society. And then the question is, well, what makes that possible? As we've just stated, it's the semiconductor. That places ASML, TCMS, and the rest as extraordinarily significant companies for the global order to be maintained. And as someone who sits at the top of one of these organizations, I would just ask you to reflect on the importance of it. And I know that there's like a Dutch humility that probably doesn't want to necessarily make a big deal of it. But if you wouldn't mind reflecting on that.
No. So and first of all, I mean, I'm not going to diminish the role we play. Secondly, I'm very proud of what we achieved. It came with blood, sweat and tears. You know, it did not came overnight and easily. We worked extremely hard to be in the position we are. At the same time, I don't enjoy being announced as you just did. You know, I it would be much without being in the spotlight of today's geopolitics, for example. Sure. It would have been much easier to just, you know, have your impact.
Mm-hmm.
So we're proud of what we do, but there's so many more things that need to come together to have the society as we know today.
Mm-hmm.
That we play a role. It's not like we exist. We communicate thanks to ASML. Mm-hmm. I would go at this far saying, if it would not be us, somebody else, likely slightly less efficient and effective. Would have filled the gap. So we're proud where we are. Without us, you and I would still, somebody would still communicate with you.
Okay, cool. Well, I mean, the sort of humility I expected to hear. But nonetheless, I wanted to just put that in there because it's impossible to ignore the sort of significance of ASML's role in the creation of a semiconductor. Because it is the semiconductor that we should all be, you know, sort of, thank you.
But my second thought is this position comes with a responsibility. If you are, when I joined ASML almost 25 years ago, I think we were number 3 or 4. There were 2 big guys ahead of us and many before us that played a big role. And of course, we wanted to climb. A position, and we did. But if you're a relatively small guy, people have a choice, you know. You fight for their attention and you like to ship your stuff and you like to improve their life in factory, but they have options. Now we have become so big that we have to deliver to the needs of our customers and avoid being arrogant, because today we provide certain capabilities others cannot provide.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is, so you have to be respectful to them. And the downside, the biggest challenge I think we face is that we should be wary of opposition, live up to their needs, and not be arrogant or try to leverage the position.
Yeah. So speaking of opposition, what are ASML's major competitors?
Depends on what you look at, but the 2 Japanese are still there, Nikon, Canon.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the more mature technologies, which is, there's an abundant need of mature technologies. If you read in the press that there's a shortage of semiconductors, it's often also the more mature technologies.
Mm-hmm.
We have fierce competition from the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the most advanced end of the scale, EUV, we are the only show in town.
And is there any threatening competition to the EUV tech around the corner somewhere that you're familiar with?
There's always people that will try to master the technology just to be more independent.
Mm-hmm.
But for the time being, as said, we're the only show in town.
Okay, beautiful. Well, let's introduce the EUV technology. Could you explain EUV technology, but perhaps maybe start with just lithography for the layman?
Now, let me start even one step before. How are semiconductors made?
Mm-hmm.
Semiconductors are built up in layers, layer by layer by layer, like tens of layers. And one layer could be, for instance, an isolator. Then you put a layer of conducting. Then you put a layer of isolator. So all these layers need to have a certain pattern in them.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you build a semiconductor? You start with a big 300 millimeter silicon wafer. For example, I put on a layer of isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And now I need to make a pattern in this layer. The patterning is done with a system which we call lithography. So we have a certain pattern put in what we call a reticle or a mask. This is the pattern we repeatedly want to print on the wafer with a machine which we call lithography.
Okay.
Next, the pattern is etched, and then so it goes round and round in the semiconductor. We have basically we are a copying machine. We copy, you know, one image multiple times, thousands and thousands of times, to make millions and millions of semiconductors. And I often refer to it as a nano copying machine.
Okay.
We copy nanometer fine structures onto a wafer.
And the wafer is, as you say, a very thin disc of silicon.
Yeah, it's 300 millimeters diameter, let's say a millimeter and a half thick. And there, like you bake your cake layer by layer, you put in the structure you want.
And just to give the listener a flavor for the complexity of this, I just, through the Experience Center, saw the 3D video of the machine. In the first component of the light coming through, you're printing drops of iron, I think it was, which is then vaporized into a flat disc that then has light shot through it to be then converted into another light.
Well,
to then go through a series of mirrors.
Allow me to take two steps back.
Okay.
Because now you jump right into what is perhaps the most spectacular part of our latest machine. But let me bridge it from how do we make semiconductors to what you just described. There are a few things important in our nano copying machine. First of all, how small are the lines you can print? Commonly referred to as Moore's law. Every 2 years, the lines have to be 30% smaller. Secondly, you need to put them at the right place. And thirdly, you need to do it at the right productivity. Back to the first one. In order to print smaller lines, we use light. The light has to change in color. So over the years, we went we already are in a non-visible light, but the wavelength of the light becomes shorter, more blue. We went to more and more blue light.
Okay.
Because the if you go from red to blue, blue light can print smaller lines.
Okay, and the smaller lines
and
converts
the smaller lines
to higher
makes
processing
it
power.
Smaller, cheaper, and faster. Okay. The chip.
Okay.
Moore's law. So, the latest step we made. So we went from we went from 365 nanometer, which is a mercury lamp. We went to 248 nanometer, which is a krypton fluoride laser. We went to 193 nanometer, which is an argon fluoride laser. So 365, 248, 193, 13.5. So we made a huge step in wavelengths. And this huge step allows us to print much smaller circuits, chips, much faster, cheaper, more energy efficient, better chips. The challenge we were facing was multiple to make EUV. This is called EUV, 13.5 nanometer light. One of them was to get a source which had enough power to create these lines in a fast and a high productivity.
Source of light. Yeah.
We, in the end, mastered the technology, and now I come back to what you just described, which is indeed our EUV source of light. There are multiple ways to generate it, but the technology that after 2 decades of blood, sweat, and tear prevailed was you shoot with a very high power laser at a very small tin droplet, not iron, tin.
Yeah, okay.
Tin droplet. The droplet moves with 50 meters per second, is 30 micron, which is 31,000 millimeter, and you hit it 50,000 times per second, smack in the middle.
Yeah.
And you hit it with one pulse, then it expands from a droplet into a fluid pancake, and then you hit it with an even more powerful pulse, and then you generate the EUV.
Was it a eureka moment where you discovered that this is how you could harness the light? Was it really a...
It came in steps where often we declared victory and then found other effects we also need to overcome.
Okay.
There was an idea to hit with a laser on a tin droplet. But first we did it with one pulse. So we just hit it once. And we were able to generate EUV, but we got stuck at 10 double digit number watts, 10, 20 watts. And we needed 100, 200 watts to get high productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I said in the beginning, it's imaging, small wavelengths, EUV, overlay, put it in the right place, but also productivity to make it cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
So to put some years to it, in 2006, we shipped our first EUV scanners.
Mm-hmm.
They had an EUV source in it. They could print on wafers. Productivity was terrible. Less than 10 single digit number of wafers per hour. So you had to wait an hour to expose a whole wafer. It took several steps to increase the power of the laser. And now to make it more complicated, so we had multiple eureka moments where we said, eureka, I have more power. The next thing you discover that the tin ends up at your optics and you quickly lose your reflectivity. Then you had to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we cracked it, we increased the power because we like to have high productivity and we found new problems.
Yeah.
So this is, I would say, 10% brilliant breakthrough ideas and then 10% inspiration, 90% transpiration to resolve all the other effects that showed up.
So it really is a story of iteration by a large number of people working at the cutting edge of their field rather than one sort of serendipitous discovery that led to...
It's fair to say individuals came up with breakthrough ideas. To get them to work in a machine you can ship across the world and then produce chips 24/7, it takes a lot of engineers.
That's the iteration.
So you need a few scientists. The ratio scientist to engineers is like 1 to 99. Get to a breakthrough idea is essential as often, but insufficient. To really get it, to master the art of having this reproduced in a fab at a high was quite a challenge, to be honest.
Could you distinguish between microchip, semiconductor, IC, and all the different jargon? Are they actually the same thing at the end of the day?
Now the microchip and the IC are the same, at least to me. The semiconductor industry is based on what we do with those chips. So that involves a lot of... I mean, take a few giants like Facebook, Google. They are very big companies. The industry fuels itself. So with more advanced chips, we offer capabilities that not yet exist, but then are being used by others, like navigation in your car. So for me, the semiconductor industry is based on more advanced chips, being used by various applications written by software engineers, which apparently solve your daily needs, like Twitter and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say the semiconductor industry is much more, than just the chips.
Okay, but in terms of the jargon, when people are reading about this industry, which has become, as you said at the beginning, though in a disgruntled fashion, become so popular, or at least it's so central to the news, the jargon is, we can think of them as the same, a microchip and IC semiconductor.
Short answer, yes.
Okay, yeah. But I realized after I asked it that there is also loads of different types of chips, and it could be...
And there are layers in this. There's those that build the equipment that make the chips, like us. Many people think we make chips. No, we make equipment that is used to make chips. Then you have those that build the chips, Samsung, TSMC, Intel, and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have those that use the chips.
Yep.
And the deeper you go in this industry, or the next step is always bigger than the previous step.
Yep.
But they all build upon each other.
Sure. I want to introduce Moore's Law and ask some questions about that.
Sure.
And also understand exponential. So the idea of Moore's Law pulsates through the walls here and windows here at ASML, as well as I'm sure chip makers across the world as well. So we've established that it's the lithography side of the business that determines whether Moore's Law is being met or not, because it is your ability to print more on the same silicon wafer that will ultimately mean the doubling in processing power and the rest.
No, here I am inclined to say no. From the beginning, Gordon Moore wrote his famous article in, 65. I'm always a year off. He thought of it in 64, he published it in 65. Anyhow, he wrote it in 65, stating that the density of the chips would double every year. He said every year at the time.
And the density is how much?
How many
layers
chips
are printing?
No. How many chips are there in, let's say, a single? How many transistors? How many components are there in a single integrated circuits, which is the same as semiconductor, which is the same as chip?
Yep, yep.
How many components in a chip? In fact, he stated that this is the number of components in a chip doubles every year. That leads to the lowest cost. That's exactly what he said. Then 10 years later, first of all, he revised his own law. Since it's not a law of physics, but an empirical law of economics, you can revise it. Gordon Moore in 75 said, I double every 2 years. At the same time, he pointed out what drove his law. And now here stands my correction. So we were only one of three. Already in 1975, he said there are three engines to this law. One is the smaller dimensions. That's us. We print smaller dimensions by changing wavelengths of light and by other means. Secondly, he said the chips get bigger. That was true for the first years, later on changed somewhat. Thirdly, and the third thing still holds today, is what he called device and architectural cleverness.
Okay.
So we make sure that you can put more transistors in, let's say, a square centimeter. But equally important is can you do it more efficient, such that this square centimeter can do more than the previous number of transistors. And that last, and even to this date, the Moore's law is enabled by multiple drivers. We still play an important role. I will not diminish our role. On top of this, you have what we call device cleverness. So how do you make a certain function? But more and more, and this has crept in over the last decade and will continue to be important, system optimization. Okay. How do you optimize throughout your phone,
yeah,
for example?
So that's the end user who's actually using the chips ultimately. They also play a role in whether the processing power can actually effectively double.
Let me explain it with an example. So we can print more transistors in a chip, but you not only have to look at the capability of the chip, but more so today also to the energy efficiency of the chip. And there ideas came up like a distributed clock or whatever chip today does. If you don't use certain functions, you switch it off. You don't run your whole chip at the same frequency and you don't run it on all the time.
Yeah.
If you would, you would drain your battery very quickly. So this system optimization to decide, you know, now he wants to make a call, now he wants to use the internet, switching off and off, on and off certain parts of the chip, doing an, let's say, energy conservation on chip, is a critical element to enable more advanced.
I think that's a really nice way of thinking about it, because I'm trying to introduce a question to you on the limitations of Moore's law. So it's really nice that you've framed it this way. But I have just some preamble here to like maybe introduce the as context sort of what exponential really means. And I just took out a very classic example of folding a piece of paper to the moon, which I'm sure you're familiar with. So basically 42 iterations, and you take this piece of paper, which I think is 0.1 millimeters thick, the whole 380,000 kilometer journey to the moon. So it's a very powerful example for a person to look at a piece of paper and go, wow, this is a ridiculous law, because it only took 42 folds, right? And according to Moore's law, every 48 months we're doubling, which means we're timesing 100 the output of it. So I wanted to show you this graph, and for the reader, for the listener at home, it's basically it's a hockey graph line, hockey stick line graph, which basically shows the value of each fold, right? And what makes this graph so interesting is that it's not until the 39th fold that you can actually visualize a significant change, right? And obviously that's because the scale is that we stopped at 450,000 kilometers. If we looked at it here, then it would also look like that. But it's just highlighting that the difference between fold 42 and 43 is 200,000 kilometers. And the difference between fold 42 and 41, you know, was only 100,000 kilometers. Things get out of hand very quickly.
Yes.
So with that large context, I wanted to ask where you thought along the corresponding curve of Moore's law we could potentially be. Because I'm assuming there has to be a ceiling with the technology that we currently have to how powerful the processing capacities of these chips can be. And this is now the question, forgive the rambling context, but are we towards the beginning or are we towards the hockey end of the stick when it comes to Moore's law?
Now, since it is a loaded question, I will first dodge it by stating that I'm glad you educate your listeners on exponential growth. Very, very few people appreciate exponential growth, understand the significance of exponential growth. There's an even more classical example with one grain of rice on the first part of the chessboard and mm-hmm. then two on the second and three on the fourth. Mm-hmm. And what do you get if you do 64? Yeah, so you cover the whole earth with meters of rice.
Yeah.
And most people think a few sacks of rice, Pershing King fell exactly. in the same trap.
Yeah.
So exponential growth, even in today's context of the pandemic, is grossly underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have exponential growth if one person infects two other persons
yeah.
and it can
yeah.
quickly go out of hand. So exponential growth is hard to get your head around. It is a reality, and it's amazing to have an industry that has followed exponential growth for more than 50 years.
Right, exactly.
So where are we on the curve? Well, many predicted the end of Moore's law and were always wrong. At some point, it will come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Exponential growth cannot go on forever. But there's a few things.
Consume the universe, but there's a limitation before that.
There's a limit between exponential growth and exponential shrink, because exponential growth you consume all resources of the universe very quickly. Exponential shrink, that's what we're doing. We make things smaller and smaller.
You can,
for instance, ask, when will you hit one atom? It's impossible to divide an atom in two. Let's say it's impossible. So if you just extrapolate the size of our semiconductor transistor and you extrapolate to an atom, that will happen in about 2040, 2050.
Okay.
So we still have decades away from this.
Hmm.
There's another way to look at it, and you say, well, you know, what about the fundamental physical limits like Heisenberg? You have a single electron, is it there or is it not there? Okay, another good decades away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Smarter people than myself have studied this topic and in the end concluded there are three barriers you may hit. The last one is the physical barrier, as I just alluded to.
Yep.
Decades away. Now, whether it's three or four decades, I will leave aside.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is the architectural barrier. How do you get a terabyte of data in and out of a chip?
Mm-hmm.
Let me come back to this in a minute.
Okay.
The third one is the economical barrier,
yeah,
which is probably the one at the end of the day that will decide.
Okay.
Now, having said all this, I am very comfortable that for the next decade, we will continue to go ahead with Moore's law, although we take the liberty to slightly redefine Moore's law. And here is not my redefinition. The chairman of TSMC, which is the biggest semiconductor foundry maker in the world. All the chips in your phone probably have been made by TSMC in Taiwan. So Mark Liu said, rather than just looking at making things smaller, we will measure the energy efficient performance.
Okay.
Because the energy efficiency of chips is becoming a real item these days. And it's very important to continue to make them more efficient, or else the internet will consume all the electricity. And it's been fairly stable, the percentage of consumption, despite us putting more and more data.
Interesting, okay.
So let's slightly redefine Moore's law to energy efficient performance. Mark Liu, chairman of TSMC, says it will continue 3x every 2 years. That's even more strict than Gordon Moore. He said 2x every
mm-hmm,
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Exponential for at least 10 more years.
That's still
that's
five
what he said,
iterations
yes,
of
yeah.
doubling.
So that means a phenomenal improvement
mm-hmm.
of energy efficient performance of semiconductors,
mm-hmm.
partly enabled by us printing smaller lines, to a significant extent enabled by further system optimization.
So the natural follow-up is like, what creates the energy optimization? You just said it's ASML printing smaller lines, but is this more in the ballpark of the ultimate chip manufacturers in their technology, or is ASML also playing a huge role in the energy efficiency?
We build equipment that is used to build chips, but how you then optimize these chips, what is becoming more and more into play is that everybody used to make one chip using the most advanced technology and then print everything at once. That was the most economical way to do it. Most performance, energy, price, all came together. Mm-hmm. More and more what you now see is that people use certain parts, some people call it chiplets, or no matter how you want to call it, you certain parts of your function you print in the most advanced node using our EUV machines, mm-hmm. or the successor of our EUV machine, mm-hmm. which is being worked upon. Other parts you can do with all the technology. So by looking at what technology do I need combined in one chip, mm-hmm. rather than printing it all with EUV, you print part with EUV and part with the older technology, you can have a more energy efficient performance.
Can energy efficiency, and forgive me if you've said this in other words and I've missed it, but can energy efficiency also trace a Moore's law trajectory where it could also exponentially double with certain time iterations to the point where
I was not clear enough. The energy efficient performance, which is defined as how much energy do I need to do a certain calculation. So joules. So if I do it faster, it is performance goes up. If I do it with less energy, energy goes up, mm-hmm. or of course the energy efficiency goes up. Mm-hmm. So I look at how fast can I do it, how much energy do I take, will follow an exponential growth according to the chairman of TSMC for the next decade.
Okay.
Even faster, 3x every 2 years is even faster than the traditional definition of Moore's law, which is 2x every 2 years.
Exactly.
So, and then look at your folded paper, you know, the last two steps, the last step brings as much as all the steps before that. Mm. That's another thing about exponential growth. So if you think of what you can do today with semiconductors and the way we communicate, think about what it will mean in a decade.
The difference between the 0.2 millimeter fold and the 0.4 millimeter fold is an arbitrary amount. The difference between the 200,000 kilometer fold and then the 400,000 kilometer fold is the difference between flying to the moon and to another galaxy, right?
I probably don't agree here. If you look back, you think that what happened in the last 5 years was phenomenal and all before that was irrelevant. But if you go back, everybody at a certain point in time has exactly the same feeling. When we replaced radios, tubes by transistors, and all of a sudden you had a mobile radio, they thought, well, this is incredible, you know. Mm-hmm. It was unable to listen to a radio unless you were connected to at somebody's home, connected to the grid. Now, all of a sudden, you could listen to radio while driving in a car. My goodness, you know, mm-hmm. my life changed.
Yeah.
Now we say the same thing. We say, you know, like 10 years from now, I have autonomous vehicles. I just call up on a car and it will bring me wherever I want while I take a nap. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, my life changed. Mm-hmm. But 20 years ago, somebody had the exact same feeling. The life-changing experiment with an exponential step was always there.
Sure. So the way you experience the exponential growth is always going to be confined within the limitations of your own experience. And so if you don't live a 1,000-year lifespan, you probably can't appreciate the difference between the 200,000 kilometer iteration or the 2 millimeter iteration.
The guy that was the first to fold the paper 8 times because world champion before him did 7 went to OG, you know. So it's almost philosophical. I think everybody has that same OG experience. Mm-hmm. It's just we're getting spoiled and mm-hmm. we need an even bigger step.
Yeah, I mean, true. I mean, we're definitely not satisfied with whatever we have at the moment, right? We definitely want to see what the next iteration is going to be. It's not enough to have a beautiful electric car. It needs to be cheaper, faster, safer, and I also don't want to drive it. And, you know, Excellent. So what are some sort of sci-fi dreamlike applications of technology that these chips are going to enable? And it is a predictive question, so you cannot say with certainty, obviously. But as someone who is really at the cutting edge of this industry, and I'm sure privy to many ideas as to the applications of these chips, is there some specific things that really excite you?
Personally, I mentioned one thing, but everybody mentioned it, the autonomous driving, you know, which is will be more than just convenience. It's another way to look at these technology changes. It enables mobilization of people that are currently restricted to their houses. The blind can drive, whereas for me it's just convenience, not driving,
right,
but taking the steering wheel. But I must admit, I find it very hard to predict how it will be used. And luckily, I'm in good company. Most people find it very hard to predict. I mean, Thomas Watson predicted the world market for computers will not be bigger than 10. I think he even said 8, but anyhow, very small number. So it is very hard to imagine. I mean, Microsoft was built on 64K memory. You know, why would you ever need more bits to run an operating system? So far, this industry has been a little bit the field of dreams. You know, you build it and they will come.
Sure.
You enable this energy efficient performance and it will be used in ways we have not foreseen. So there's always this next thing out there which people go after, which justified the investment. But in the end, many more things will happen. So that's my take. I do not have this... I'm a builder of the field of dreams. I'm convinced that it will be used also to good use of humanity. There's always also some bad use, but overall it will help society in many different ways.
Sure.
But how and when to be determined.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of folly to make predictions into an infinite possibilities of the future just based off our finite experience of the past, you know, just because the chips have been ubiquitously used with making our phones nicer looking and faster responding and our computers higher processing doesn't necessarily mean it will continue in the same trajectory, and it could potentially introduce technologies that we haven't even dreamt of or thought of yet.
Very few will have said many long time ago, phones will in fact be navigation devices. Or get you into touch with your, or share your daily life with thousands and thousands of people that seem to be interested. Nobody.
I've noticed now a couple of jaded comments towards social media. I get the feeling you don't find this the best application of the field of dreams.
It's a good example. It's an application I would have never thought of myself.
Right.
I opened my Twitter account a decade ago. I think I still have one follower that is waiting for my second tweet.
You have 12 followers. I
12, 12, okay, 12. Okay, they're all waiting for my next tweet. But it's a good example. And yet, many people use it and feel horrible if it's switched off. So
yeah,
this will enable things to happen which nobody had foreseen.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the software side of this business because I find that also a really fascinating component, and specifically in the acquisition of talent and labor from across the world. Traditionally, I guess you're viewed as a total hardware company, but the truth of the matter is software is just as important these days.
Yeah.
So could you start by explaining how sophisticated your software is to a layman? So maybe make some example comparisons, I'm not sure. But then...
Indeed, software is a big thing of making the machine work. We have like 10,000 people in R&D, development engineering, and I think the biggest departments are the software department.
Mm-hmm. Within ASML.
Within ASML. Yeah. So I'm only talking about ASML. Just to make all machines work takes more software than hardware people.
Mm-hmm.
On top of this, we have products that are software only. You know, we have packages that make our systems perform better, just by calculating what the system could do only if you optimized it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so software is a very critical element of our machine. Now, you mentioned the labor market. That varies. So to attract top software people, that depends a little bit where you're located on the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And how people perceive the company. So luckily in the Netherlands, and I think nowadays even in Europe, we are well known, we are very successful. Success attracts top talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you like
mm-hmm.
to be part of a success story rather than, you know, something that goes down the drain. So it's still, here it's still okay. But if you work in Silicon Valley and you're next to Apple, Facebook, Google,
mm-hmm.
Alphabet, you name it, it's in fact much harder
mm-hmm.
to be envisioned. And I'll share a short, small anecdote. I'm not sure what I should, but I will. So one of my colleagues working in Silicon Valley, you know, he goes to the barbecues in the neighborhood and
mm-hmm.
then people ask him, what do you do? And at some point the word has to come out. You say, I work for a company that builds equipment. And they look at you and they pity you. You know what
really?
I mean? You mean you still involved? Yeah, but I write the
yeah,
software that
yeah.
goes in the
you
hardware.
You mean you're not making an algorithm?
Yeah. You have to build something to make money.
Right.
How pathetic. So the way the skill of building complex machines and operating them with software is perceived is actually different in different parts of the globe.
Yeah.
Luckily, also in the Bay Area, people know that we push the boundary in every possible direction,
mm-hmm.
including in the interaction of software and hardware, or just software only.
Mm-hmm.
Machine learning, artificial intelligence is become a critical element, component, competence of our division in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So we, those that are in the field, we can correct the image, but
mm-hmm.
the image is of somebody that has to build something, put it in a box and ship it, is not perceived as positive.
Yeah, it's bizarre to me, and this is me just projecting my own worldview, but it's bizarre to me that that isn't viewed as a romantic prospect. And that for some reason, you know, making a marginal improvement to the Instagram algorithm is a romantic prospect. I don't know, I totally understand that. As a person who lives in Europe and has worked for American companies, I know that American salaries are significantly greater than European salaries. And I just wonder, is it still the case that the best software engineers are going straight to Silicon Valley and working for one of the big five?
Put it like this. Top talent has a price, whether it's software, hardware, whatever. So
mm-hmm.
you want to be attractive to top talent, including the... first of all, what do we do? What impact does it have to humans? But also, what do you pay?
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the total package. And you have to be competitive in the labor market, and we will be. But on top of their salary, luckily, people also look at other elements.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, if you frame it to them as you're creating the field of dreams, which you've done a few times, I guess that could be
the final
look to get them on the board.
It's also, and then different generations look different to what a job should offer. It's also interesting. Your viewers can't see me, but I've been in the industry for quite a while. I'm just attracted by, you know, solving the impossible technical task.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, then so many people told me that EUV would never work, and we got it to work, and I
mm-hmm.
take great pride in this.
Yeah.
Others, but whole generations are grown up, and they ask me now, if they ask for a job, they say, what difference will it make to our society?
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I mean, I can not only tell them that I have an impossible task for them to solve,
mm-hmm.
we also make a difference.
Yeah.
And so what drives people is not only different in different parts of the world, it's even different to one generation to the other.
That's cool. And are you finding that it's more younger tech that's more interested in that last proposition? Younger tech, younger people?
From my perspective,
mid-20s,
much younger.
Early 20s, okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. There's even names to the different generation. But yeah, many people, sincerely, younger people,
mm-hmm.
not only want to make money, which is fine and good with me, they also want to understand what is it this does to mankind.
Amazing. Not to take it off too much on a tangent, but you talk about Peter Thiel's 0 to 1. Are you familiar with the idea of it?
No.
And maybe it's a bit too much to introduce, but basically, like, he's in that book, he looks at sort of different generations, and
yeah.
he's got a very
yeah.
American-centric perspective, which is a shame. Big media, unfortunately, never looks at European or Australian or Asian, whatever, but it's always American-centric. Anyway, American-centric, and it looks at different generations and how they would think about the future. Right, and that's reflected in many things across media, across, you know, how many lawyers are being employed versus venture capitalists and whatever. if you follow Thiel's logic, it would almost be the opposite of what you've experienced firsthand, that the newer generations are in fact too jaded to give a crap about the future and just want to make loads of money. But in fact, you've experienced the reverse, which is quite an interesting insight, I think, that runs contrary to what is a very popular narrative, even though you might not have heard it. Okay, I want to introduce to you now probably questions which you're least interested in answering, and those are the geopolitical ones. You know, it's just short.
You're not the first.
I'll start off with a low ball then. Could you address the shortage of high-grade silicon and whether it is as desperate as people would have you seem, that there is in fact not as much of it available as you would like, especially
high grade silicon. It's an abundant,
taken into account future manufacturing.
You're the first to even bring it up. Silicon is sand is silicon oxide. So
but
you remove
like fine sand. Right?
Yeah, we
it
have
can't
plenty
just be
of
sand.
In Holland, go to the beach.
Yeah, but you can't use beach sand. It needs to be like special
river
sand.
You heat it up and it will... You have to make it very pure. No, that's not an issue. Zip.
Okay, well then.
Zero.
It's good to put that to bed. I interviewed a guy called Vince Beiser who...
He probably sells you high-grade silicon.
Yeah. if you ask him, because it takes into account the same silicon that's used on solar panels... as well, if you take into account all the different types of manufacturing that silica is used for, then there's supposedly a shortage. But I'll definitely take you at their word for that. What about this? What about the biggest geopolitical question that has been spoken about in the context of semiconductors over the last six months, 8 months, 1 year, whatever? And that's the role of a centralized supply chain, essentially, in two countries in East Asia, and one of them being a massive political risk in TCMS in Taiwan. How do you reflect on this as one of, I think, your biggest customer?
I think our industry, and therefore the world, to get back to the beginning of the story, is connected only through global collaboration, processes, supply chain, operates the way we operate. If you look at your phone, I hear it for Samsung, but if you take your iPhone, that there is software, intellectual property from the US, the chips have been made in Taiwan, they've probably been assembled in China, the chips have been cut in Malaysia, it used the Dutch equipment. All of this is connected.
Mm-hmm.
If we would go to a disconnected world, in two or three or multiple blocks, the overall thing will be far less efficient and effective.
More expensive as well.
We have seen, put it like this, we have seen the value of global collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
In research, engineering, production, markets, you name it. And indeed, there is a lot of discussion about having multiple blocks being formed.
Mm-hmm.
It will hurt the whole industry. It will not say we die, but of course it will hurt.
And what do you mean it? Like what hypothetical?
The progress of innovation will be slowed down.
Mm.
Now, I'll give you an example of first-hand experience. We discussed EUV before. 2 years ago, I had the privilege to... we had a special session in our annual conference. We were celebrating that EUV finally worked. It was in production. The phone I held is the first phone, 2019, that had the chips with EUV.
Mm-hmm.
It has been worked upon for decades. So on the podium, they had people that were involved in bringing it from fundamental research to a phone.
Mm-hmm.
I had the privilege to be on stage, and if you look at stage, we had Americans from the national labs in the US, we had from Intel, we had people from Japan, Kinoshita-san, one of the first pioneers that believed in the technology. We had people from Germany making the optics, we had people from the Netherlands building the equipment. It was for me a prime. And we had people from Korea making the chips, and we had people from Taiwan.
Right, right.
So we had Asian, Europeans, American, all on stage. It would have taken us much longer, and potentially it would have never happened if we had broken this up into Europe, US, and Asia.
Mm.
So this happened 2 years ago, is for me a prime example how this connected world led to EUV, led to a next step in Moore's Law.
It's undoubtable that globalization and the security that has existed over the last 30 years, 40 years of the existence of ASML, enabled the collaboration, as you just explained, where you've got a perfect cross-section of humanity up on stage celebrating this amazing achievement.
Building the field of dreams.
Building the field of dreams. But my question is more, how do you think about the risk of that sort of order and that chance of globalization potentially being disrupted majorly by a big disruption to TSMC within the global supply chain? That's more the question.
To be honest, I don't know. And you can think about what if the multiple what ifs that would be greatly disruptive to this industry. I will not be too specific to bring people up on ideas, but there are. This is a small community with a few players, each having their own role, and take out one out of the equation, and it would look completely different.
Right.
So I the likelihood I haven't even thought of it, to be honest.
Okay. have you had a moment like this before in the history of the company where you have where geopolitics has influenced the sort of the way you guys are thinking about the work?
There's always been geopolitics. As an example, when we started EUV, I started myself in 97, mm-hmm. starting EUV program at ASML. We got involved with the national labs, the ones I previously mentioned, that in around 2000. And also then we had geopolitical discussions, not like what about country XYZ, but if I allow you to access this technology in my weapon lab, what will it be? So it's always been there. I must.
Can you give details of what that looked like?
I can, but I will not.
Oh, okay, sure. Fair enough. Go on, please.
So there's always been this element. I mean, people like to take care of their own, whether they're European or Americans mm-hmm. or Chinese, you know, there's always this element of quid pro quo, I give you something, what do you give me back?
Right.
Even more so than the whole theme about security and so whatever. Today, I will admit to that, it's hot. It's more hotter than it has been for a while, but it's always been there.
Mm-hmm. We have 5 minutes left.
Yes.
And so I'll just finish off with one, which I think is a really exciting one. You know, I'm not from the tech industry. I have an extremely superficial understanding of how the machine works, right? But I think it's a fun question to ask nonetheless, which is the EUV, the latest iteration of ASML's products, is it the most complicated machine ever made by humans?
Yes.
Fantastic. Can you open up on that? I mean, because isn't that such a remarkable achievement and thing to reflect on?
Well, you know, yeah, and this is...
In
the mic, yeah. No, so I said in the beginning, I'm proud of what we accomplished, and very few people realize how complex a machine is. They do see a big machine with a lot of tubes and pipes and wires.
Try and enlighten us. How complex are we talking here?
No, so I'll give an example what makes it difficult to build a machine. If you want to print something, we want to print something very small, very precise at a location. So you want stability. You want to have it precisely at this location.
Mm-hmm.
That means you typically make things heavy. You know, if you want to look through a microscope and you want to avoid the thing shakes while you look at it, make it heavy. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you want to make it cost effective, you want to print very fast. You want to move your system in and out at a very high speed. To make it, on the one hand, very precise, which calls for heavy. On the one hand, very fast, which calls for light.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of the dilemmas you face in designing such a machine.
Mm-hmm.
How do you optimize between those dilemmas? And there's quite a few in there. On the one hand, we need productivity. We pump an enormous amount of energy in this source. And at the same time, you want to control the temperature and a fraction of a Kelvin. We are printing lines. If you look at your fingernail, within the next 3 seconds, it will grow as much as the line we're trying to print.
Wow, that's an amazing
metaphor. I mean, we're talking nanometers here, 10 nanometer lines. And I mean, you can look for a long time at your finger. You clip them probably once per week or so. And then so within a few seconds, it has grown more than the precision of the system we are building.
Wow.
So, and these dilemmas in where on the one hand you should make it X and the other hand you should make it the other way, all had to be resolved. And it's a combination of these different disciplines, mechanics, software, physics, all come together in this machine, few people, and it boils down to hardly anybody understands what a nanometer is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one billionth of a meter, and to control this while you move things at high speed, while you pump a lot of energy through your system, makes this. I always said NASA did great things, but this is more complicated than the SpaceX rocket.
Wow, and so that 3 second of the fingernail growing is a nanometer. If you continue on the trajectory of Moore's law, or superficially what we were explaining before, it gets even smaller. But not only does it get a bit smaller, it gets doubly smaller.
Yeah.
And so that's almost, I'm asking, what are the limitations to this? It surely gets to the point where
we're going to hit the atom in 30 years. So as long as we can afford it, it will happen.
Wow, unreal. Joost, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind a slick in one more, which has nothing to do with ASML or technology, this is more a reflection of you and your personality and your interests. And I ask this to every single guest.
Okay.
If you could witness a conversation between any two people of history, dead or alive, who do you want to... Maybe you don't listen to podcasts, maybe I'm making too much of an assumption, but if you could watch a conversation between two people, who would they be?
You take your
in the mic.
the famous example is Albert Einstein and Merlin Monroe.
What are they going to talk about?
No. I will. But Einstein, and I'm not a scientist. But the famous one with Merlin Monroe. The rumors is Einstein said, if we would have children, it would have been great if they have my brains and your look. The other way around would be completely disastrous. But. And I would have loved to witness that conversation.
Yeah, okay. Well, amazing. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Finally, guys, thank you for listening all the way to the end here. I just want to say that my ambition is to corner the podcast market for eclectic curiosities in whatever country it is that you are listening in. Discoverability within the podcast algorithms are in the stone age. There is actually one variable that matters, and that is the amount of 5-star reviews with a comment attached. So I please ask that if you're keen as a bean, if you enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoyed this particular episode, or that you just enjoy the individual content creation in general, and you're okay with supporting me, do share this with a mate. But most importantly, pump that good juice into the algorithm. Pump via 5 stars. And a review. I really cannot overstate how helpful that would be to me. So thank you guys. You've hung around to this stage. Look at the website that I've done. Look at my website, atlasgeographica.com. Have a look at the other Bloody Good Business profile. Or maybe if you want to wet your beak with some Carl Jung, some Nassim Taleb, there's a lot of stuff on there. So cheers. You're a bunch of legends. Take it easy. Ciao.